Hello everyone and welcome to episode 608 of So You Want to Be a Writer, the podcast that's all about writing and publishing. My name's Valerie Koo. I'm CEO of the Australian Writers Centre, the world's leading centre for writing courses, and I'm your host. What has been happening in your world? I want to give a big shout out to Sarah Speedy, the author Sarah Speedy, who is one of our incredibly talented graduates. Sarah started, you know, before she discovered the world of writing, she was a full-time stay-at-home mum and she wanted to write picture books. So she enrolled in the writing picture books course because, you know, her kids were growing up and she wanted to kind of do something. And she decided that the course was flexible and was pretty comprehensive. So she did it. Long story short, she's now a successful published picture book author. Her debut picture book was Mozzies and Flies. Love that title, right? And it even got shortlisted for the Speech Pathology Australia Book of the Year Awards. And she followed that with another picture book called Meowster Chef, as in meow. And then I think the cat theme continues because she's just released Boss Cat, published by HarperCollins, and Wild About Book Week with Larrikin House. So I love that not only is she a prolific picture book author, she's also collaborating with a variety of different publishers, which is such a great way to ensure longevity in your author career, right? So she's prolific. Anyway, Sarah did the courses Writing Picture Books and the Writing Picture Books Masterclass. So now she does school visits and is signed with the Beyond Words Literary Agency and, you know, has really carved out this fantastic career. And I just think it's very inspiring. So big congratulations to Sarah Speedy on that. Oh, and I also wanted to remind you that the sale is now on and it's only going to be on until midnight Sunday, the 30th of June. Up to 40% is off a huge range of courses, self-paced courses at the Australian Writers Centre. So this is just an incredibly great time, end of financial year. Do something for yourself. Get up to 40% off, I think, about 50 courses. So make sure you nab them because even if you're not ready to do it now, you have 12 months access to do your course. And there are so many great ones to choose from, whether you want to learn about creative nonfiction or historical fiction, romance writing, short story essentials, how to write about murder, and a whole heap of our Focus on Bundles and Fiction Essentials courses. And the Fiction Essentials courses are excellent to deep dive into a particular area of writing craft, like dialogue or point of view. If you're not clear on point of view, you need this course. It's such a great course. You will understand point of view by the end of it. Anyway, you can check it out yourself. Just go to writercentre.com.au/sale, and the special prices end at midnight on Sunday, the 30th of June, end of financial year. And now let's welcome back our resident Renaissance woman, our resident creative writing tuner at the Australian Writers Centre, an all-round dollar outer of fantastic writing tips.
Wow. Matt Newman. What an intro, Valerie. What, you should just say, here is the amazing, incredible, fantastic, unbelievable Nat Newman.
Awesome. I'll do that next time. I'll do my best, Bert Newton. Okay. That shows my age. Okay. How are you, Nat?
I'm good. How are you, Valerie?
I'm good, good. What's been happening in that world?
What has been happening in that world? Just making progress on my YA novel edits, and I'm writing a play at the moment and running Words at Dawn and, you know, all the usual things. And I had a gig last week. So that was
what do you mean? What kind of gig?
Oh, my music teacher makes me sign up for the end of term gig, which involves about 30, 10 to 12-year-olds and me. None of the other adults will sign up and do the gig.
Okay. What do you do at your gig?
I sing. So So last time I did, what did I do? Oh, it was a long time ago. I sang Carole King's "You've Got a Friend."
Ah, yes.
Anyway, but this term, I managed to convince my teacher, who's an incredible woman. You know, she's classically trained. She and when she chooses a song, we often, you know, we'll do a musical number, or we did some ABBA and, you know, whatever. But this term, I convinced her to do a Nine Inch Nails song. So she had to learn to play this piece on the piano, and God bless her, she did. And so we did that, and so that was pretty fun.
Oh my God, it's like when I made my cello teacher let me play Bon Jovi on the
Yeah.
cello. It sounded unusual. Anyway, all right, well, I hope your gig went well.
Yes, it was a lot of fun. Thanks.
What's your writing tip for us this week?
So beta readers are something that people ask us about a lot. So for anyone who's not familiar, beta reader is someone who generally is a reader who will read your entire story or manuscript once it's at a, let's say, at least after your second or third draft, I would say. And then provides feedback kind of on the entire story, not necessarily as an editor would, but as an actual reader would. Their sort of general feelings about it. And so we do often get questions. I get questions from my students a lot about where they can find beta readers once their course is finished, particularly after, you know, particularly once you've been in a course and you meet all these other writers and you have that workshopping aspect, and then 6 months down the track, you actually finish your novel and then you actually want some beta readers. So, where can you find beta readers? The number one spot is contact those writers again. So,
Yeah, for sure.
even though they've read early drafts and whatever of your manuscript, still, that's your first port of call, is to find other writers, because, you know, they can actually provide some. Usually, they can provide some useful feedback. So definitely look to your writing groups first, or anyone that you've swapped work with in the past. That's going to be your first point of call for a beta reader.
Don't give them your vomit draft.
No, God, no. Your
You
beta
know,
reader.
work. Yeah, well, you got to work on it first, right? You're the alpha reader. You are your own alpha reader, and you need to actually make sure that it is at a very good stage before you bother to send it to a beta reader. Otherwise, you're going to get a whole heap of feedback, which you already knew anyway. So, and you because you should have gone through it and maybe do some, if you're not sure what to do, have a look at the course Cut, Shape, Polish, because that's all about how to edit your own vomit draft, you know, how to edit your own work. And after that, when you're happy with the re-edit or rewrite or whatever it is, then look for beta readers. Otherwise, you're kind of wasting their time and yours.
Yeah, 100%.
Yeah.
That is such a good point. That I mean, beta reader. I mean, beta comes from alpha, beta. It's the second. It's the second read. So yeah, absolutely. You are your alpha reader, and you have to make sure it's at a decent standard before you send it to your beta reader. Otherwise, yeah, it is going to be a waste of time. Like, imagine if they come back and they're like, "Oh, you missed all these commas here, and you know, your punctuation is your dialogue is punctuated incorrectly, and
Oh, it was just really confusing because
yeah."
for some really obvious reason which you could
Yeah.
have fixed.
Yeah, your characters, one of your characters changed names halfway through, and you know, and you didn't update it, and all that sort of
Yeah.
basic stuff. That's the stuff you really need to sort out. And also make sure that, you know, that your beginning and your middle and your end are nice and clear, and your climax is clear, and all that sort of stuff before you even look at beta readers.
Yeah.
But yeah, so if you can't find any beta readers, like if you haven't joined a writing group before, you haven't done any writing courses, and you don't have that resource available to you, then look at other groups that you're in, your book club, even if you're in a sports group or a D&D group or something like that, you know, find out who there is a reader, and see if they'll be willing to be your beta reader. And yeah,
I
any
think it's
other.
hilarious how you picked a D&D group.
Well,
Dungeons and Dragons for anyone who isn't sure.
so many of my friends, Valerie, are into Dungeons and Dragons. I can't do it because I'm not good at good at group work.
My God.
So I can't do Dungeons and Dragons. I'm also not competitive, so as soon as there's a competition, like any sort of hint of competition, I'm like, I'm gonna go get a beer, and then I just don't come back. Like, I'm so uncompetitive.
But it's true that people in your other groups, there's going to be some of them who are readers, you know, there's just people who just like books, right? So you don't want to be sending it to somebody who doesn't read.
No, yeah. And the other thing you don't want to send it to, and this is something that a lot of people don't realize, don't send it to someone that you live with or someone that you're related to. It obviously that's a really broad rule. And it's you can break that, of course. But generally speaking, your partner, your mum, your sister are probably
Unless
not.
they're authors or somehow in the
Exactly.
industry,
Yeah.
yep.
Or unless you know for sure that they can be completely objective, which, let's face it, I sent my dad a crappy video that I edited for an assignment, and he wrote back and said, "This is the best thing I've ever seen." I'm like, "Well, I don't think it is." But it was very nice of him, but it wasn't true.
Yeah.
So that's the sort of feedback you are going to get from someone who loves you. So do be careful, like probably not someone you're related to or that is your partner. And we also have our Facebook member community
Graduate school.
and the graduates group as well. Yeah.
Yeah.
So if you've done any of our courses, then you've got access to some of our Facebook groups. And also if you're just a listener of the podcast, we also have the podcast community. So you can always post in there and ask people in there if they're willing to be beta readers. So those are just some of the places that you can
Yeah.
start looking around. And once you've got one or two, it's kind of all you need, I guess, at first anyway. You don't want to get 10 people to read it, and then you're going to get 10 different opinions. And also, that's just going to take months and months and months for everyone to read it and come back to you. So yeah, just start with one or two and see how you go from there.
Yeah, great. And in the graduate group, I know that Madeline Tehu and Megan White, they weren't even in the same course together, but they connected in the creative writing graduates group, and they reached out to each other and ended up reading heaps of each other's work, and both ended up being published. They're both on there. I think they're both on their second book, second novel. So yeah, fantastic. And that both their novels have gone really well.
I
So
love that. See, that's the power of a writing community. Like, I think people sometimes are afraid, or they think maybe writers aren't going to be supportive. No. Writers are so supportive of everyone in the writing community. Like, we're all there to help each other. So definitely reach out to other writers whenever you can.
yeah, it's a great community. Okay, great tip. Thank you so much for hanging out with us this week, Nat.
My pleasure. Thanks, Valerie.
I'm going to move on to my competition this week. This week, I'm giving away three copies of Death in the Air by Ram Murali. This is a gripping locked room mystery, blending high society intrigue with sharp wit. Okay, so here's the blurb. Ro Krishna is the American son of Indian parents, educated at the finest institutions, equally at home in London's poshest clubs and on the squash court, but unmoored after he is dramatically forced to leave a high-profile job under mysterious circumstances. He decides it's time to check in for some much-needed R&R at Samsara, a world-class spa for the global cosmopolitan elite nestled in the foothills of the Indian Himalayas. A person could be spiritually reborn in a place like this, even a very rich person. But a person or several could also die there. Samsara is the Sanskrit word for the karmic cycle of death and rebirth, after all. As it turns out, the colourful cast of characters Ro meets, including a misanthropic politician, an American movie star preparing for his Bollywood crossover debut, a beautiful heiress to a family jewel fortune that barely survived partition, and a bumbling white yogi inexplicably there to teach meditation, harbours a murderer among them. Maybe more than one. As the death toll rises, Ro, a lawyer by training and a sleuth by circumstance, becomes embroiled in a vicious world under a gilded surface where nothing is quite what it seems, including Ro himself. Death in the Air is a brilliant, teasing mystery from a remarkable new talent. There you go. So, Death in the Air by Ram Murali. I have three copies to give away. Entries close on the 1st of July. So, go to writercentre.com.au/win for your chance to win. I've made it super easy for you to enter, and it's writercentre.com.au/win. And now, Are you ready for the word of the week? Well, I hope you are, because I like this word, embrocate. Embrocate, E-M-B-R-O-C-A-T-E, embrocate. What does it mean? Well, it means to moisten and rub with a liniment or lotion. These days, the term seems to be most commonly used among cyclists when talking about, you know, how to avoid chafing or whatever. So why they say embrocation instead of moisturize, I don't know, but there you go, embrocate. I did wonder when embrocate stopped being used as commonly, though, apart from cyclists. So I ran moisturize and embrocate through Google Ngram, which is the tool that lets you see the usage of a word over time. Moisturize was barely used in English before the 1960s, and it didn't overtake embrocate until, believe it or not, the 1980s. So it just shows how quickly a word can fall out of use. There you go. Embrocate. And that was the word of the week. This podcast is brought to you by the Australian Writers' Centre and our popular course, Creative Writing Stage 1. This course is the perfect way to unlock your creativity and explore the world of writing. You'll learn how to create memorable characters, believable dialogue, and captivating plots, all in a supportive environment in this 5-week online course with your very own tutor giving you personal feedback each week. Have a listen to Tanya Blanchard.
It was really important for me to become a published author, particularly because of this story that I've written, The Girl from Munich. It's a story really close to my heart. It's a story of my German grandmother and growing up during World War II and what happened to her. So the fact that I was published with her story, first and foremost, is something very exciting and very meaningful to me. The course has had such an impact on my life and on my writing, on my life, because I've always dreamed of one day becoming published and never imagined it was possible. But after doing the course, I realised that it was something that was definitely attainable, and I was able to work towards that. As far as my writing goes, it improved my writing dramatically. It gave me so much more confidence that I could write. I had the skills behind me to do it now, and that meant that I could work faster and harder and just get the work done. And I've got so many more ideas of things that I can do now, and I just can't wait to write more. I write full time now. It's absolutely amazing that I'm able to do that. I would absolutely recommend one of the courses to anyone. If you're a writer or aspiring writer, go and do it. I wouldn't be sitting here without these courses that I've done. The skills that I've learnt have helped me along my journey, and I'm now sitting here with a published book in my hands, and I never thought that this was possible, and it's because of these courses. Take it from me. Go and do it. You won't regret it.
If you'd like to find out more, go to writerscentre.com.au/creative-writing. Now let's move on to our writer in residence this week. Today I'm talking to Michael Brissenden. Michael is an author and journalist. His first book of fiction, The List, was published in 2017. A second thriller, Dead Letters, also features the federal investigator Sidney Allen and was published by Hachette in March 2021. His latest novel, Smoke, published by Affirm Press, is out now. Thanks so much for joining us today, Michael.
It's a pleasure.
I'm so excited to be talking to you about your novel, Smoke. Now, for readers who don't yet have their hands on a copy, can you tell us what it's about?
So the initial premise is that a wildfire goes through a small town in California in the Sierras. After the fire has gone through, they find a body in a shed, which they assume has been this person is a victim of the fire. They then, after an investigation, discover that the shed was locked from the outside and somebody's used the fire as cover for a murder. After that, it spills off into a broader tale about corruption, about an individual, a family, and a community under pressure from a changing climate, about the community under pressure from development, from there's police corruption, there's all sorts of multi-layers going on there. And it features the protagonist, Alexandra Markov, who is a 43-year-old detective from the Los Angeles Police Department who grew up in this town, but blew the whistle on a group of corrupt cops, and they then turned the investigation back on her, and so she was stood down and went back to her hometown and joined the local police force.
Okay, so where in the world did there were so many elements to this story, but where did the idea for this novel come from?
Well, the idea came, that initial premise about somebody using a natural disaster like a bushfire to cover up for a murder, came after the 2020 fires here in Australia and New South Wales. And my family has had a little house on the south coast since the late 1950s, early 1960s, the house was built. It's a very small community, and that was the first place where that big Kairouan bushfire burnt through, just before Christmas in 2019, in fact. And they had a lot of resources down there, so they managed to save the town. But everybody was incredibly traumatised. And then the fire, of course, as we know, blew out from there and destroyed a whole lot of area and homes and individuals. And I was talking to a lot of people down there who were really traumatised by that. And also, and so that's where that initial idea came. I thought, well, you know, in a community like this, everybody's traumatised and preoccupied with the fire. Somebody could easily have used that fire to perform a murder or a crime or something like that. But I didn't want to set it there because I didn't want to be, I didn't want it to reflect on the people I was talking to or their experiences in particular. So I wanted to come up with an invented place. So I started writing an invented place in Australia. I'm sure you're going to ask me why it was set in the US then after this, but I'll tell you now. So I started writing about an invented place in Australia, and then it started to rain, and it rained here for about 18 months. But it was burning in California, and it was burning in Greece. And so I thought, and you know, as a correspondent, I have actually covered fires elsewhere, particularly in California. So I knew the territory, and I thought, well, this is a really great opportunity to not only set it somewhere that nobody knows, like a made-up place, but also set it in a different country. And it was a big challenge to do that, but it was one that I thought would be a great thing to do. And as it happened, I think it was a good thing to do because it, you know, all of those other issues that are in the book, things like poverty, drugs, corruption, healthcare, all that sort of stuff, you know, we have those issues and problems here, but they're magnified so much in a place like America. And it sort of helped to raise the temperature, to use a pun, to raise the stakes, I guess, and give it more urgency, because those things, although they are problems and issues here, as I say, they're magnified in a place like California.
So I want to backtrack a bit, because before you started writing novels, you had a very long career for decades as a journo for the ABC. You've worked for the 7:30 Report, for AM, for Four Corners. Now, writing and researching for broadcast and for nonfiction and for journalism is completely different, of course, than writing an entire novel that is completely made up. So first of all, at what point did you think, I'm going to write fiction now?
Well, I've always wanted to write fiction. I just have never really had the confidence to do it, or perhaps it just wasn't the right time. So I did actually write a manuscript about 25 years ago, which was, 80,000 words. I thought this was a great thing, and I sent it off to a whole lot of people. Only one of whom got back to me, publishers, agents, all sorts of things. One agent did get back to me and said, look, it's really not for me. It's not, we're not really interested in it, taking it any further. But I really did love this line in this chapter, the opening line in this chapter. And I thought, wow, out of 80,000 words, you picked out one sentence, But that was enough, because I thought, yeah, you're right. That sentence was just evocative. It had everything. It was just, and that sort of kept a spark of interest. I knew that, look, I didn't, that 80,000 words didn't work, 90,000 words, it didn't work, but I still had something I could do. I still had something that was enough to keep me going. So then I didn't really write fiction until I started writing my first book in around 2016, 2015, when I was the defence and security correspondent at the ABC. And I was hearing a whole lot of stuff about, that was the time where we were all worried, terribly worried about Islamist terrorism. And The discussion was very black and white in the media, but it was much more nuanced behind the scenes, and there was a lot going on. There was a lot of talk in the intelligence community about how to bring those immigrant communities on board, how to open a dialogue with them. There was a lot of criticism about the way the media was covering it. There was a lot of criticism about the way politics was using it. And I just thought there was a lot of stuff there that would make a great story. And so I just started writing with a lot of these conversations that I'd been having in the background, but without having to attribute anything to anybody and having the freedom to take the story wherever I wanted to take it. It all started to work, and I got to the end of it and it's like, wow, the story developed. There was room in the story to talk about all of those other sort of nuances that I think weren't really being discussed in a way that wasn't journalism, that was narrative and dialogue and place. And, I think the best of this sort of genre writing can really take you on that sort of story arc through narrative and all the rest of it and tell you a whole lot of stuff that reportage or journalism can't, because you're not trying to bang people over the head with a didactic essay. You're trying to actually entertain them and give them something that they're going to enjoy reading. But hopefully by the end of it as well, people think about, well, there's a whole lot of things going on there.
So when you started writing that, because you were hearing all these conversations happening around you and you thought you wanted to explore it, well, when you actually started writing, did you know the story or did you just kind of just start writing and see what happens?
Look, I sort of knew the story. I knew who the characters were going to be, the main characters. I knew there were points in the story that I wanted to hit. I didn't really know how it was going to end. And I didn't know, often I know what's going to happen in 3 chapters or 4 chapters time, but I'm not quite sure what's going to happen in 12 chapters time. But I know sort of how, I know I have to hit a point somewhere, and I'm not quite sure how I'm going to get from point A to point B. But in that book, like in every book, really, I just started with a premise and an image. And that, to me, if you get that right, then you get the atmospherics right and you get the, you pull the reader in. And as a writer, I'm pulled into the narrative as well. I find that just really helps to just get on a roll and keep going. And even if I do know where it's going to go, sometimes that changes as well, and that's the beauty of writing fiction, is that it can take you all sorts of places and it doesn't, you don't have to be constrained by, well, that didn't really happen, or, someone didn't say that, or, I don't have to be constrained by that. If that's the way it goes, that's great.
Now let's talk about Smoke then. You said you usually start with a premise and an image. So the premise is obviously somebody covers up a murder after a natural disaster, and presumably the image is that burnt out shed. Yeah. And the fires, the devastation of the fires. Did you with this one know what was going to happen, or also there are so many elements, as you say, corruption and so many themes in it. Where did they all come into it?
I don't know.
At least you're honest.
Yeah. I mean, I sort of, I knew I wanted to hit a number of things in the story. And I know what it's like when, so I think this idea of a town under pressure from an environment that's changing slowly but inexorably, it's changing. And there were, in small towns, there are always those people who are going to take advantage of moments in time. And after a bushfire goes through or a wildfire goes through a place, it's a crisis situation. And people use that as a cover for all sorts of things. Like I was really captivated by how when a fire goes through a place, suddenly you start seeing hills and gullies and valleys and things that you could never see when the canopy was there. And often there are things in there that people don't want you to see. But the same thing can be said about communities as well. It really strips the cover off a community. So suddenly people are, you're seeing things about your environment that before that happened, you didn't see. So I just liked that idea, that that sort of metaphor, if you like. There are a number of things I wanted to hit. I wanted to hit local, this idea about a local council, a corrupt local council, wanting to develop areas and using this as a way to do that. I wanted a female protagonist as a police officer because I had been just, you know, over time talking to a lot of female cops about how they have to deal with this sort of entrenched misogyny in what is a very masculine environment, and how they're expected to perform, the things they have to not say, you know, like I think there's a point there in the book where Alex says, you know, you have to speak up, but you can't be shrill. You know, you can't say nothing. You have to be careful about how you say it. And I was really intrigued by how somebody goes through that. So I sort of wanted to include, so that's how she developed, really. And then there are, you know, the other things in there, like her mother, who's in the nursing home at the time I was writing this. My mother was going through that experience. And, you know, I felt a sort of, I guess it was a sort of catharsis writing that, you know, like it was really was very close to my mother's experience and my experience with her going through the last stages of dementia in a nursing home is pretty tough, you know, and a lot of people are doing that. And it just, as I started writing it, it occurred to me that, well, you know, wouldn't this be the best place that was going to be developed under development pressure, and how that would impact on Alex, the community and the family. So that worked. And I also wanted to talk about, you know, this idea about local news and local media and how important it is to a community and how much under threat it is. And I didn't really see that at the start. There's a newspaper editor who, no real spoilers, but some, you know, a third of the way through the book, she dies, she gets murdered. I didn't really see that happening, but when it happened, I thought, boy, yeah, this is, you know, that's a good way to sort of get into that. So, you know, there were things I wanted to hit, and they helped just the story, they helped move the story along. And I find when you're writing, you just want to, for me anyway, I want to get to the end of a chapter and be ready, be wanting to write the next chapter, you know, and I want it to hang so that people go, oh, what's going to happen next, you know? So, yeah.
So talk to me about the timeline of your first draft, or a draft that you were happy with. Hmm. When did you write it, and how long did it take, and was it like a full-time endeavor at that point?
Yes. So I left the ABC nearly 3 years ago now, and, you know, with the intention of writing full time. So I started writing this, and as I say, you know, the longer I got into it, then, you know, I decided to change it up and move it and put it in a different country. But by that stage, I'd sort of written about 2/3 of this thing, and I'm talking to my agent about this as well, and he goes, well, you know, it's probably a good idea if you're going to do it to, you know, to, if you want to do it, let's do it. So I went to California and did a big research trip in California. And then I came back and finished it and changed it all, used all of that information. It probably, I would say that first draft took me about a year, but it if I hadn't, I mean, only because I decided to change it up and move it and, you know, so that probably took a year. And then, you know, I was going through I changed agents, I changed publishers, and, you know, well, we were getting another publisher, so we got another publisher, and then, you know, my agent went through it as well, and we changed a few things, and, you know, raised the stakes a few times, where he just sort of said, look, you know, that, and then it went to the publisher, and they had their views about it. So it was probably another year, I would say, before the final draft was done. But, you know, there was a few drafts in between that.
And when you are focusing on your manuscript, when you're getting your first, you know, version out there, what does your day look like? Do you write at home? Do you write in a cafe? Do you aim for a certain number of hours or a number of words? What's the actual practical look at what that is like?
It depends what I'm doing. Before, when I was working full time, I would write anywhere, often in hotel rooms, whatever, whenever I had time to do it, because, obviously you're trying to fit it around your day job. But now I write here at home mostly. Sometimes if I'm traveling, I'll write, wherever. I'm happy to write anywhere, but I am only really good at writing in the morning. I'm not good at writing in the afternoon or in the evening. And I'm a morning person, and I get up quite early and I start writing about 7, and I'll write till about 12, and I'll try and do about 1,000 words. That's really what I try and do. That's in the first draft. And then when it comes to going through the second draft, I find the second draft much easier than the first draft. Like, getting the story down, I find actually it's hard work. But once you've got something on the page, you've got something ready to edit, that's the process I really enjoy, because then you can just go back and start thinking about the structure of the thing and thinking about, do we know enough about this character? Do we know about, and really, really building it from there. So when I'm doing that, I can do that anywhere, and I often don't do it sitting in my study. I often just don't go to a cafe or whatever and do it, because it's quite nice having an environment outside this room.
Yes. And so when you are, you said that you know that there are certain points that you want to hit in your story. Is that in your head, or have you storyboarded it? Because someone with, like a broadcast background such as yours, you kind of know the key elements of visually what's gonna happen in your broadcast story. So how have you planned it in your head or on any kind of piece of paper?
So I have a whiteboard, and I often divide the whiteboard up into 3 columns. One's character, one's place, and one's story. I fill up the whiteboard, and then I take a photograph of the whiteboard, then I wipe it clean, and I start again. And so I've got, essentially, I've sort of got, what the whiteboard thing is for me, I can connect things, I can move, I can draw lines, things come to me at different times. I'll write it down so I don't forget it, and then I'll put it, and I'll have a word count at one point on the whiteboard as well. So I'm crossing that off, and I have a little calendar about sort of what I want to hit at certain times. I have points that I want to hit on the whiteboard, and sometimes I'll have little lines, but it gets very, like a bowl of spaghetti after a while. So I have to take a photograph of and wipe the slate clean and start again and try and then order the one that I've just taken a photograph of and give room for more stuff to happen. So the whiteboard is a work in progress, like the book, but I find that very helpful.
Okay, so let's talk about when the whiteboard goes up there for the first time. You've got character, setting, and what was the other one?
I have character, setting, and sort of story, basically.
Okay, story. But when you're doing your first go at the whiteboard, what are you writing about character? What are you writing about setting and so on?
I can tell you what I've got up on the whiteboard now.
Okay.
Like, it's all over the place. It's so it's not really structured at the moment, because I'm still thinking. I've got a couple of scenes that I think I've got a bar half full of men who've drunk themselves out of a marriage and into a lonely bedsit. We're all here because of the Russians. But that's not the common thread. What binds us is our hatred of Russians. These are just the ideas, right?
Ideas, so yeah, okay.
They have no real. I know they are scenes, right? And I know sort of the characters that those scenes are going to. In my head, I know the characters. I've got some characters off onto the left-hand side. This next book is going to be set in Las Vegas or near Las Vegas. So I'm doing a big study of Russians in Las Vegas, and because Alex Markov is a Russian, this is going to be the next. She's a Russian immigrant, and she gets then to explain it for your listeners. She gets taken on by she gets taken on by the FBI because they need Russian speakers to do this particular investigation, and that's where she ends up in living in Las Vegas. So there's a lot of stuff that I haven't really worked out, but as there's names, there's scenes like that, there's themes like abandonment, QAnon, you know, like those sorts of things are there. So it's a bit mixed up at the moment, but I'll take a photograph of that and then I'll start again and I'll start plotting it out a bit better.
Right. So initially they're ideas and it's not done in any kind of linear fashion, but presumably because you're going to take a photograph of it some months from now, potentially there's some linear aspect to it because you've organized it in
most
that way.
Definitely. And if I forget, I can go back and look at the photograph of, you know, what I was thinking at that time. You know, sometimes I get stuck and I think, well, how did I get there? And what, you know, perhaps it's worth just going back and having a look at where I was, what I was thinking all those months ago, you know, about what this character was going to do. And the motivations of the characters are sometimes really important to just sort of sketch out like that, you know, because I know a lot of people do that in Scrivener and whatever, you know, as well. And I use Scrivener, but I don't use it like that. So I much prefer to do it this way. I mean, you know, everybody has different ways of doing this.
Yeah, for sure. That's really interesting. So there's a bunch of you who have this, you know, story, this veteran background in journalism, and now you're writing these fantastic thrillers and fast-paced books. There's Chris Hammer, there's Tim Iliff. What do you think that background in journalism, what aspects of it have been beneficial that you've brought to this career?
Look, I think for a start, we're not afraid to pick up the phone and ask someone a question, right? If you get stuck. Also, research is really important for these books, but you can't write it like research. It's not journalism we're writing. We're writing, you know, entertainment, essentially. We're not writing journalism, but a lot of those craft skills are still relevant. So when I went to research Smoke, for instance, it was like going on a Four Corners shoot in the sense that I just had a list of people I needed to interview. I knew what I needed to get from them, and I knew how that information was going to fit into the story, but they didn't have to go on the record. No one had to be, you know, there was none of that, and it was much more relaxed. But, you know, I think I know how to get to those people, right?
Yeah.
It's and I know the value of research. The challenge is for journalists is to make it not seem like journalese when you're writing it, you know. And that's, you know, it's hard after a lifetime of writing that way to really bash that out of your writing. And I'm constantly trying to do that and aware of that. You know, if you go back and read it and it reads like a journalist has written it, you're going to get rid of, you know.
Oh, I've read some of those. What are the things that you've looked out for? Because that is a danger with journalists that you end up with all these info dumps of stuff that is.
Yeah, don't over explain. Like, don't over explain. You know, part of it is the reader wants to be guessing too. And the reader can, and I think I've learned this over time. I think you need to give the reader space, you know. You can't tell them everything about anything, really. Like, you just cannot tell them everything. You need to lead a reader along, but you need to give them enough space to actually enjoy the experience of finding out, you know.
Yeah. So on that,
try and explain too much.
Yes. So on that, everything has to unfold for the reader in this story, and they want to. That you need to keep them guessing as to the outcome. What devices or what things are you aware of to make sure that you do to ensure that it's not the reader doesn't guess it too early or whatever?
Yeah, I mean, I do go back and make sure I'm not telling too much, you know. And giving the reader, you know, because often you need to go back and pull stuff out. And you think, oh, I can't really tell them that because, you know, they need to, that needs to come later, or that needs to be revealed later. And yeah, I'm also a great believer that people will follow a character through anything if the character is a really good, multi-layered, complex character. Much more than, and that's sort of almost more important than the story in a way. I mean, you know, the story is important, but people won't follow a good story if the characters are no good. But sometimes you'll follow a character even though the story is a little, you know, you don't know enough about it, or you're not, you know, you're not entirely sure about it. So it's important to get the characters right. It's important to get readers invested in those characters. So sometimes, and you know, sometimes good editors will pick that up too. They'll come back to you and say, listen, we need to know more about this person. You know, you need to put this person earlier in the book. We need a much more emotional investment in this particular character earlier up. So sometimes I pick that up, sometimes an editor will pick that up. Yeah, I can't remember what the
So
question was
let's
now.
talk about Alex. So your
Yes.
protagonist is
Yeah.
Detective Alex Markov, and she is a woman. So what did you do to make sure you got that voice right? Because you are not a
No. Well, look,
woman.
a number of things, actually. Over my career, I've spoken, as I think I mentioned, you know, to a lot of female cops in various at various levels, and those frustrations, you know, are just sort of buried away in things that I've, you know, I know those frustrations. So that's sort of what I wanted, but I also wanted. So she's 43 years old, and she's given up a lot to be a cop. And she went down a rabbit hole with bad people, and then realized that she needed to do something to address that, but also her own life and her own, you know, she was running away from her past to that she was hoping the police force was going to give her the family that she felt had fallen apart. She wanted connection, she wanted family, she wanted that sort of things, those sorts of things. But you know, she gets to 43, she's hasn't got a partner, she hasn't had any children, she you know, has gone so far up the police ladder and sort of hit a ceiling. It's a tough place to be, right? So I also wanted her to have I wanted that immigrant experience as well, the first generation immigrant, second generation immigrant experience, which she has. Her father's a her, fa her parents are Russian. But this is where research was really interesting. So I didn't I needed to know where what the American experience of someone like that would have been, where she would have lived in LA, how she would have made an internal affairs complaint, and what the process of doing so is, and what happens when you've done that. So here's where the research comes in. So I didn't ha I had a couple of cops, very senior cops, none of whom were women, who said they were going to talk to me, but I had nothing locked in. And I went to LA, I had nothing locked in, and I thought, what am I going to do? So I drove up to the police academy. I drove straight into the car park. There was no security. I walked straight in the front door. There was no security. I walked straight into the. There was a live firing exercise going off in one in a paddock just to the side. There were guys strapping on bulletproof vests in the armory, and I walked straight in. And they said, "What are you doing here?" And I said, "I'm an Australian author, and I'd like to talk to somebody." And they said, "Okay, come with me." So they took me to the chief's office, and there was a 43-year-old female sergeant there who sat me down, and we spent 2 hours just basically going through all of the things that I wanted to know. And she was great, you know, she was fantastic about all of that same sort of stuff about the frustrations and all the rest of it, but also about where someone like that would live in LA, how they would have got there, That
What a gift.
was amazing, right? It was fantastic. But that was serendipitous. But I mean, I think
Yes.
you do as much as you can to try and know what are going to be the motivations of your character, how they ended up where they are. And for me, it was really, it was an enjoyable experience writing her. It was really interesting sort of place to go as a writer.
And did you get any feedback from women saying, mate, you've got to use this word instead or something?
Not really, no, I don't think, I mean, a lot of women read it in its various forms. And none of them said to me, oh, a woman wouldn't say
Well,
that.
you obviously nailed it. It's very authentic. It's
Yeah,
really,
I think so.
it absolutely works.
Yeah, I think so. No, I
In
didn't.
its final form.
I mean, yeah, women read it all the way through, and I was waiting, but it didn't come.
right, awesome. So, are you working on your next novel now?
I am, yes, which is the
And
whiteboard I
yeah.
was talking about. It's
Oh,
starting to take
yes.
shape. Yes.
And it's going to be Alex again.
So I think there's a lot more to explore in her as a character. And I think the challenges of, she needs to grow in different directions and be challenged in different ways. And I'm not finished with her yet.
It's great that you can take that arc. All right. Fantastic. So, let's finish with what would your top three writing tips be for people who would love to be in a position where you are one day, writing full time, living their dream? What do they need to do to make that happen?
It's a good question. I think well you need to start writing. You can't edit an empty page. So, people often talk about I want to write, I want to be a writer, I want to, well, start writing, because you'll find once you sit down and actually start writing that ideas will come. The muse doesn't come if you're not actually engaged with it, So it's very important to start and to keep going and not to worry about it's not the finished product. What you're putting down is not the finished product. There's nothing that can't be changed. You can always go back and do something again. You can always move stuff around. It's not, but it's really important to get those initial ideas, characters, motivations, all that sort of stuff you need to get down. Secondly, I'd say you've got to read. Like, reading is really important. And particularly if you're writing genre, you need to read, you need to invest in reading in that genre, because there are lots of tropes in crime, particularly, and the best crime tries to subvert them and doesn't follow the tropes all the time. And you need to know what they are and what to avoid, I think. And you need to know what's good and what's not in your own mind. And so you need to read very widely. And thirdly, I'd say don't be afraid of editors, because editing is a really important part of the process. Don't be precious. Everybody, particularly when you get to, if you get a publisher and a publisher is investing their time and effort and editors and whatever on your work, that is a great gift. Right, that is, and everybody is working to produce the best product they can. So, don't be afraid of editing, and don't be precious about it.
That's great advice. Everyone, get yourself a copy of Smoke by Michael Brissenden. You won't regret it. Thank you so much for your time today, Michael.
Thanks, Valerie. It's great.
I hope you enjoyed my chat with Michael. Now, I want to leave you with this fun fact. Did you know that the word factoid was coined in 1973 by the American writer Norman Mailer? And he described factoids as facts which have no existence before appearing in a magazine or newspaper, creations which are not so much lies as a product to manipulate emotion in the silent majority. Of course, these days a factoid is usually a bit of maybe unreliable information that has been repeated so often that people accept it as fact. And sometimes people misuse it and actually think a factoid is just kind of like a little fact. Anyway, that is the origin story of a factoid. All right, thanks for joining me this week. I really appreciate you hanging out. And if you want to join the listener community on Facebook, just go to Facebook and search for So You Want to Be a Writer podcast community and request to join. Love to have you in there. It's free and lots of aspiring writers from different walks of life. Also, feel free to connect with me on social media. I'm at Valerie Koo on Twitter and Instagram, and I'm over at valeriekoo.com. As usual, you can check out all of the things at the Australian Writers' Centre at writerscentre.com.au. Thanks for listening, and I look forward to chatting to you again next time. This podcast is brought to you by the Australian Writers' Centre, a world leader in writing courses. Our popular course, Crime and Thriller Writing, is the perfect course if you want to write a gripping page-turner. You'll learn about the different types of crime and thriller fiction, ingredients every good story needs, how to manage characters, pace, suspense, and climax, publishing options, and much more, all in this five-week course with Zoom sessions with the wonderful crime and thriller writer L.A. Larkin, who will give you personal feedback on your writing every week. Find out more at writerscentre.com.au/crime. That's writerscentre.com.au/crime.